You're listening to Valley Edition. For years, California winemakers have earned their reputation by producing big, bold wines, and they've used all that science has to offer to make the state a global behemoth in the worldwide industry. But there's also something else going on in California, a new generation of winemakers who are looking to old world traditions for their inspiration, and in the process are creating something truly unique. They're the subject of a new book by our next guest, John Benet. Since 2006, he has been the wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and his book, The New California Wine, A Guide to the Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste, was published last month by 10 Speed Press. John Benet joins us now. John, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Revolution in taste. Revolution is a bold word. It implies a break from the past. What are the hallmarks of this revolution as you see it?
It was not a word we chose lightly, and it's a word I'm sure some folks think is probably too strong. What I would describe it as is wines that do what California has historically done best, which is to offer both the complexity and the nuance that people have often associated with the old world, with the exuberance that they can find in California. And for a long time, most of California wine was trying to emulate the first, and then for about 15 years or so, it was really chasing the second in what I call the era of big flavor. And I think what we're seeing now is people turning away from just sheer impact to wines that offer a true perspective on the glorious diversity of what California can offer.
You use a very interesting word when you're talking about some of the winemaking practices that have made California so popular and such a big industry, and you use the word technocratic. You talk about this battle between technocratic winemaking and artistic winemaking. What do you mean by that?
I think technocratic is simply acknowledging that the way that the post-war industry in California was built up, in no small part with the work from UC Davis, but also Fresno State and other places, placed an enormous focus on the science of winemaking. And that's not a bad thing. You want to be able to employ it in appropriate ways. But especially as the industry grew really faster than anyone could keep up with it, it became very convenient for science to be the only mode of work in the cellar, and for people to simply run their wineries on the numbers. And I think anyone who really believes in the timelessness of wine as a culture has to accept that you just don't make great wine that way. You have to pull away and really see what the specifics of the place that you want to farm can give you, what the vintage will give you, rather than simply sort of adding a commercial yeast that will give you one flavor or another, making sure you hit all your chemistry, and sort of following quite literally a textbook approach to winemaking.
Now, you're from the East Coast originally, spent a lot of time in the Northwest, and as I understand it, you came to your current job with a bit of a reputation among some in the wine industry. How has your experience both on the East Coast and also in Washington and other places shaped your ability to tell this story?
Well, I grew up in New York, and I grew up with, obviously, a fair amount of European wine, but also a fair amount of California wine. There was absolutely, bottles from folks like Robert Mondavi on our table, enough that when I came out to California for the first time as a kid, really, in 1985, it was very clear to me when we went to Napa just how special a place it was, and then went to college, did all sorts of other stuff, moved to Seattle, as you say, and really happened to be lucky enough to be in the Northwest at a time when especially Washington industry was just booming, and really in a large part it was built on the growth of small wineries, and I became very used to walking into these no-frill warehouses in South Seattle, wherever, and seeing basically, a mom-and-pop operation, quite literally, that we're making some of the best wines in the Northwest, and we're getting recognition for them. And so what I think that imprinted on me was that American wine had a great potential future at small scale, and that as much as there obviously is a big industry in wine, that what would push forward the tastes of Americans in terms of the wines that we'd like to drink, what would push forward California's and America's reputation as a global wine producer was going to come from a small scale. And so when I got here, it was more than a little bit of culture shock.
Tell us about how has that changed? You document so many of the people who are leading this revolution, the winemakers and folks who are pursuing their own path and doing it at a very small scale. You talk about the folks who are doing urban winemaking. They're renting warehouse space and something that is not often our traditional romantic notion of the winemaker out in the estate. How has that changed, and who are some of the people who are leading this revolution?
I think what I saw was that there have always been small winemakers in California, and there's always been folks who've really worked diligently, often not getting a ton of attention. But I think, you know, a few years after I was here, and I was really looking for folks who I felt sort of shared my view of how the wine world worked, it became evident that there were more and more winemakers, you know, at small wineries, often sort of running their label, you know, in the second 12 hours of their day after their day job, who were asking the same questions that I was about what can California represent in terms of wine? What can it produce? What is its great potential? What can it offer to the world? And at first, you know, you would find a handful or I found a handful of folks who were doing this, folks like a guy named Abe Scherner, who had a very kind of small, semi-experimental winery called the Scolium Project, a guy named Steve Mathiasen, who actually started in the Central Valley and in Lodi, working on organic agriculture and other stuff, and then kind of moved to grapes and then eventually moved to Napa and has become a very prominent viticulturist and really started to ask deep, deep questions, one about how Cabernet should be farmed, but also about what else Napa could produce. People like Ted Lemon of Literai, who is on the cover of the book, for no small reason, who was, among other things, the first American to run a domain in Burgundy, but then came back here, and rather than what people often talk about, which is wanting to make Burgundian wine, he said he wanted to apply all the things he had learned to really discover the full potential of the North Coast, in his case, and also to having seen really kind of awful farming in Burgundy, you know, really, you know, just dramatically dead soils, that he wanted to go and look at how you could farm in a brilliant, distinctive way that would let you get to real quality and to real terroir.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, our guest today is John Bonnet. He is the author of the book, The New California Wine, A Guide to the Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste. He's also the San Francisco Chronicle's wine critic. And this book is really interesting in that you go through all the different regions in the state and talk about what people should look for and who are the people who are doing some really interesting things. And also really, from a journalist's perspective, do a great job of telling some very fascinating stories about the person behind the wine and the winemaking world. I want to talk about the San Joaquin Valley in a little bit, but before we do that, you talk about this new revolution. You also, though, mentioned that in some ways it's a return to not only old world traditions, but California traditions and bringing back some of those old flavors.
Yeah, I think if you look at the style of wine that that people made, let's say, 40 years ago, when the Robert Mondavis and Warren Winiarskis and Beau Barretts and Paul Drapers of the world were really kind of finding their footing and really showing the world how great California could be, the wines were Californian in a very distinctive way, but they, and to the point, I should say, that the French sort of mocked them for being too ripe, and these are wines at maybe 12.5% alcohol. But they were wines that had a correspondence, let's say, to styles of wine that that existed elsewhere in the world. And Cabernets were made to be somewhat longer lasting and fresher. And as I often like to say, they tasted like Cabernet rather than just like capital W wine. And Zinfandels were absolutely robust. I mean, that was an era when Amador Zins, which even, you know, were big, but not nearly at the level of flavor that they've sort of grown to and the sweetness they've grown to, found an audience when, in fact, Zinfandel had an extraordinary diversity of style, and people made Zinfandel Nouveau. They made claret-style Zinfandels. And it, in some ways, it's simply going back and, in you know, with the knowledge of 40 years of winemaking, saying, what was it about these wines that people loved? What is it about old vine Zinfandel that really is distinctive in a way that no other wines in the world can be? What is it about, frankly, grapes that have been in California a long time and everyone forgot about, like, say, Trousseau, which is both the great grape of Francis Jura, but also a port grape and known as Bastardo, and had been in the field all over the place in the 19th century, totally forgotten about, and then slowly sort of rediscovered here. Why should that not be a California grape? And so one of the things that frankly surprised me as I did more reporting on this was, in some ways, so much of the things that are exciting to me now are very much based in the past, not in the sort of short-term history as people come to think of California, where everything is Cabernet and Chardonnay. And both those grapes really have maybe a half-century history, even less in some ways if you look at the acreage growth. That there's so much that has gone on in the state in terms of a diversity of winemaking, a diversity in the field. And in some ways, we're simply circling back to acknowledge just how much California can do.
Speaking of that rebirth, you tell the story of Francis Ford Coppola and his efforts to bring back the Inglenook name to its, at one point, very vaunted reputation, and a reputation that had been sullied by really cheap box wine. He was presiding over an era where he was tearing out vines, and he said, hold on, let's take a step back here and return to the art of winemaking, not this the science. Can you tell us that story of how Inglenook changed?
Sure. Well, you know, Francis, I think, has sort of suffered every lump possible in the course of having what I guess was Inglenook and then Niebaum Coppola and then Rubicon and is now Inglenook again at the cost of, I don't know, about $50 million to kind of come full circle. But I think he simply acknowledged that he had followed the trends. He had followed the things that many winery owners did, which was you picked riper, you dropped a lot of fruit, you sort of planted the latest Cabernet clone, and you followed all the kind of fashionable instructions, and that would lead you to get the scores that would then prove your worth. And at some point stepped back and simply said he didn't like the wines. He felt like there wasn't really enough soul in the winemaking. Or really sort of, you know, farming that spoke to what he thought great farming should be. And so he wanted to revise things just in a practical sense. But then the final sort of coup de grace on it was that he looked at the old bottles of Inglenook Cabernet and Claret from the mid-century when in the John Daniel era and realized that at auction they were still fetching record prices. And so he surmised, and I think rightly so, that for all of the years that Inglenook had been sort of bought and traded off as kind of cheap jug wine, exactly as you say, that the true legacy of that name was still intact, and that if he reattached it to this truly historic property in Rutherford, I mean, the site of some of the greatest Cabernet-based wines the world has ever seen, that it was not only kind of, you know, healing a wound in Napa's history, but that it would ultimately resonate, that people would realize that Inglenook was and could again be a great and historic property.
Let's turn now to an area you call the Abyss, the Central Valley. You also call it the fiscal core of California winemaking, and it really makes the whole system work. What do you mean by that?
It was very important to me when I was reporting for the book that I get out and I see the side of California that I hadn't really seen. I think almost no wine writer ever goes to see. And so I reached out to some folks and they wanted to go to maybe Clarksburg and Lodi, and that was fine. But I said, I want to get to the thick of it. I want to see the real heart of what sort of, you know, cheap table wine comes from. And so ultimately we made our way to Madeira, and to me, actually, this is one of the most interesting parts of the book. And I have to say, the Abyss was actually not my term. It was a term coined by one of the folks who took me out there. But it was really crucial to me to get out and see what sort of industrial scale farming looks like, what it's like to farm, say, French Colombard at 25 tons an acre. And really, the most significant thing to me was that that it is possible to make that a profitable venture when you look at it simply as large-scale farming would be for any other crop. But the flip side being that my conclusion, my takeaway was that the economics of farming for really cheap wine are brutal. And I think have probably over time not served growers terribly well. I think growers, have, if anything, are now more worried and more distrustful of large wine companies who have an extraordinary way of fiddling with contracts to suit their needs. And so it was one thing where I sort of wanted to go to the absolute opposite end of where kind of $20,000 a ton Napa Cabernet farming is, just to see how the world works. And it was eye-opening. It was eye-opening to see Ruby Red, which ultimately becomes Mega Purple, which is kind of the great additive of California wine, how it starts out as grapes in the field. And it was neither as dramatically unsettling as I thought it might be, nor really inspiring. I mean, it was good to see that there is a way to make those numbers work, but at the same time, I had to keep asking myself, what's the quality of the wine that those go into? And, you know, is there ultimately a sustainability in growing, let's say, Zinfandel for white Zinfandel at 18 tons an acre when you have to drill a new well every year at, you know, $250,000? I'm sure your listeners know that water is not an insignificant concern. And so I wanted to go out there because I wanted to at least explore the economics of what it means to try and make farming like that work.
You mentioned Mega Purple, and that was something that was an eye-opener for me as I was reading this book. I had not heard of this product before, but you call it the third rail of California winemakers, but apparently it's quite popular with many winemakers. Tell me more about Mega Purple.
Yeah, and I suspect Mega Purple probably isn't even as big a deal as it was a few years ago, but essentially it's a grape concentrate. They take, like I said, typically ruby red grapes, which are a cross that was designed in the 50s, I believe, and really intended mostly for color, and concentrate it enormously. And what it does to wine, and you add it in infinitesimal doses when you're blending, is two things. It adds color. So from an era when people worried about red wine being deep and inky, it would give that to a wine that was maybe a little bit sort of wimpy in its way. And it also adds, and people rarely discuss this part, it adds just a tiny bit of sweetness. And there's a lot of interest by larger scale wineries in finding ways to add just a bit of sweetness to wine without necessarily making a full-on sweet wine. And so Mega Purple is this very convenient way to tweak not only inexpensive wine, but also, and I think this is where it was unsettling for people, often very expensive wines, to add those two aspects and ultimately try to boost your prospects with critics. And it's not a fundamentally bad thing if you use it in cheap wine, but it is something where you have to ask, if you're paying $80 or $100 a bottle, why couldn't they have done the farming right so that they weren't having to add an additive basically at the end in order to come up with a finished product that was maybe more aesthetically pleasing? You know, why essentially weren't they doing their jobs in the first place?
Very interesting indeed. Let's talk a little about the world of the wine broker. This is another one of those areas in the world of winemaking that is rather tight-lipped, and people don't talk about it a lot. But you mention it in your section on the Central Valley that many of the big clients for some of the wine brokers wind up using grapes from other parts of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's always been, you know, both the promise and also the dark edge of the California appellation is, you know, if you're making sort of a California appellated wine, then you might get some of your grapes from, let's say, Monterey or from Paso Robles. But then, yeah, you're reaching out to a broker and you're looking for sort of, you know, bottom dollar grapes, often from the San Joaquin, and using that to essentially make your numbers a little better. It's one thing even to do it in a wine that's just marked California, but when you suddenly see a wine that's, let's say, Central Coast or even Napa or Sonoma, where there's clearly, a little bit of Central Valley fruit used as an extender. I mean, that makes some economic sense. That's how the industry has operated, and in some ways, sort of historically, it's how you know, fruit from the Central Valley was harnessed. Even I would say, you know, before the modern era, even just in the years after Prohibition. But the flip side is, it really doesn't give people a sense of what California can do. It doesn't say, you know, this is the value of, let's say, Lodi fruit, and Lodi has some fascinating, really kind of amazing places to grow wine, especially as you get out to eastern Lodi and you climb to the mountains. And I suspect that, you know, if there were more attention, that people would start to find additional places. I'm just thinking of somewhere like, let's say, Oakhurst, where there's definitely at least a handful of really interesting vineyards as you start to gain a little more elevation and get back up to places where you can, you know, you get a little bit of cool nights, and you can grow really good quality grapes, but that's just not the way the industry is set up. The industry is configured in some ways to just make the consumer in, let's say, Kansas or in Tennessee or in New York just think about California overall. And I would argue, I don't think that's ultimately done the growers of California a service, because it hasn't let people really start thinking specifically about what it means if a wine is from Lodi, let's say.
You mentioned the winemaking programs at UC Davis and Fresno State. Are those programs obviously very focused on the technical, the scientific side of winemaking? Are they turning out this new generation of winemaker? Where are they coming from? And are they going to adapt to this new trend in some way? Can they bring more of an artistic element to their programs and their winemakers?
I think they're making a lot of progress, and I should also, to be fair, I should also probably put Cal Poly at SLO into that mix, because they're turning out some very, very talented winemakers, especially kind of going to Paso Robles and working in the Central Coast. I think there's been a lot of progress. The last time I was at Davis, I was talking to students who were absorbing the science and who were following the standard course at the V&E program, but who also were planning to go off and work with these very avant-garde producers in France or in northern Italy and, let's say, Friuli, and really were using their education essentially for great good, for the opportunity to work in an artisanal mold to make wines that are very traditional wines, simply with the perspective of a good winemaking education. And so I think that there's been a lot of progress. There's going to keep being progress in terms of wine education, but it's also always worth remembering that, to some extent, these programs are largely funded by big wine companies, and so ultimately their great goals are going to be to turn out folks who can work for big wine companies.
Before we go, where do you see things going from here? Is this a trend that has legs? Is it something that can continue to grow and sustain itself?
Yeah, I think it absolutely will. And I think it's not as though all of a sudden the industrial side of the wine industry in California is going to go away. It's absolutely there. It'll continue to be there, although I think it's going to face more economic pressures because farming, for many things, is going to become more complicated and more difficult. But, yeah, I think that as there's this new generation of smaller producers, it's always been the small, more elite producers that have led California and really that have defined it for sort of, you know, for consumers overall, but really that level of consumer that's interested in fine wine. And I think what's happening now, and it's growing almost faster than I can keep up with it, is that there is a realm of new young producers that are giving us what I would argue is this unprecedented diversity in American wine.
Our guest today has been John Bonnet. He is the author of a new book called The New California Wine, A Guide to the Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste. It's brand new on 10 Speed Press out of Berkeley. John is also the wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.